we go back into mountains and waters, Dogen's rant section. And it's particularly about how we use words and language and teachings. And what's the value in Zen, this special transmission outside the scriptures, known for its non-reliance on words and letters. Why would we study in such a detailed way and get into all these workings of Buddha's teaching and the ancestors' teaching and Dogen's teaching? What's the connection to our practice? What's the value? And since you're coming to listen to this, you probably feel like there maybe is some value. But I think it's a good question to just explore for the rest of our lives as Dharma practitioners. What is the connection between Dharma study and our experience and the freedom that this practice is about? Anyone have any ideas offhand? Or how you see it? How you see Dharma study, besides being interesting, because I think it can be really interesting and fascinating. And it's always great to learn more, but how it actually aids our practice of dropping off views, for example, dropping away conceptual views, letting go of our fixed ideas by bringing up more ideas. Yes.
Our perspective is extremely limited. And the more teachings we absorb or have the opportunity to listen to, we keep shifting our perspective because we keep getting more ideas. And sometimes it stops some of the ideas that we already have or turns them. So I think that the change of perspective is really good. I'm just happy with Graham and telling him how it was a wonderful holiday. Even though they were so anchored here that they're moving on to the next thing. And he said that he felt a lot about having been here so long that he has a feeling that he's taking a lot of prasara for granted. And then when he moves on, he knows he will get a better perspective. And I think it's real similar in getting teachings from various teachers. There's always something new. There's always either a new point of view. If it's not specifically the teaching, it's a point of view that they're teaching. And I think it opens it up.
That's great. Well put. Thank you. Yeah. That widening our perspective of all the possibilities so we're not just focused in one particular way. Yeah. And often the teachings are about that very point. Dogen's often just trying to widen our perspective in the crazy way that he does that. And of course, emptiness teachings and the way that that keeps coming up as a theme in this Mountains and Waters, the relationship of form and emptiness. And I feel that I'm not just making that up. I think that this is actually in Dogen's intention in here, partially. And emptiness teachings, even though that may be one of the hardest parts of Buddhism, hardest things to understand, I think it's one of the most liberating because it's basically just showing us how any fixed view or stuck position we have is empty of what we think it is. And a fixed view may just be like that we're sitting in this room. You might not even consider that like a fixed view, but that's a limited perspective. We're sitting in the small retreat hall, but in terms of emptiness, we're not sitting in the small retreat hall. So in so many ways, those teachings just remind us that what we think is happening is not really what's happening. So that in itself, to hear that from so many different angles, is ultimately liberating. So now Dogen's going to kind of dance around this sixth precept, this bodhisattva precept that we call not speaking of others' faults. He likes to play very dangerously close to that precept sometimes. And, you know, he's talking about, you know, nowadays in great Song China, Song Dynasty China, which is the present time, those people in China who I met when I was over there who don't understand anything, he talks about. But often he talks about the Japanese people too. Some interpreters of Dogen say that he's actually talking about those people, but it's just a way to actually be talking about the people that he's talking to in his temple right there. And maybe because he doesn't want to criticize them directly, because then they would, if he said, "You people are total idiots," or something, then maybe, just like if we heard that, we'd be like, "Well, I'm not listening to that." We would stop, we'd discount everything he said. But maybe the people listening are like, "Yeah, those people in China," and then as they hear more and more what he's saying, they think, "Oh, I'm kind of that way too." Luckily, Dogen doesn't notice that. But maybe that's really what he's doing, right? As skillful means. This is sometimes a Zen thing. We hear these stories of like, you know, I say something to you like, "Can you stop doing that?" But I'm really talking about the next person over. And kind of like, maybe I feel like you can hear it, but the next person over is like, they might be really offended and hurt. So I'm really offering that for that person. Sometimes those things happen in skillful means of Zen. So it could be like that. But I would understand when Dogen gets into this kind of mind that he's about to, he feels really passionately about Dharma and truth, and really wants to like people not to go down sidetracks and false understanding. He really wants people to be free, and he's just so passionate about it that it sounds like he's ranting. So here it's particularly about irrational. People thinking that Zen is irrational. So some of us might sometimes think that Zen sounds really irrational. A lot of these strange Zen sayings sound like, "Well, that's not, that doesn't make any sense." Thomas Cleary has a translated book of Dogen's called Rational Zen, and he just, I don't think he gets too into the, maybe he explains a little bit about the title, but then you read Dogen and it often sounds like it's totally irrational. Maybe this Mountains and Water Sutra sounds that way. But that there's this underlying logic and rationality to it that Dogen's just bringing out in a very poetic way and playing freshly with words. But there's specific teaching here. So this is the approach of this kind of Genzo way study, is we're making what sometimes seems like irrational words, pulling out some possible rational interpretations. So Dogen says here, "Now in great Song China there are careless fellows who form groups. They cannot be set straight by the few true masters. They say that the statement, 'The eastern mountains travel on water,' or Nan Chuan's story of a sickle is illogical. What they mean is that any words having to do with logical thought are not Buddha ancestors' Zen stories, and that only illogical stories are Buddha ancestors' expressions." So, I think in ancient and modern times, this is often Zen is like this crazy, illogical, irrational. And koans are that kind of irrational language. And then the other schools of Buddhism are very logical and rational. And he's criticizing this view. Nan Chuan's story of a sickle is a nice example here. You may have heard this story that a monk is coming to Nan Chuan's temple to practice with him. And on the way, as he's approaching, he's not quite sure where it is, but he's passing a field, which is actually one of the monastery fields. And Nan Chuan is working out there in the field next to the temple. And he's got a sickle, and he's cutting the grass. And the monk comes by, doesn't know that it's Nan Chuan. He says, "Excuse me, which way to Nan Chuan's?" And Nan Chuan says, holds up his sickle and says, "This sickle cost me only $3. And the monk says, "I didn't ask about the sickle, actually. Which way to Nan Chuan's?" And he says, Nan Chuan, still holding the sickle, says, "It cuts very well." So we have stories like that. Are they illogical? Or is it a very, very logical and straightforward exposition of Dharma position? The Dharma position of Nan Chuan. Which way to Nan Chuan is the question? And Nan Chuan could say, he's asking, like, where is Nan Chuan? Or what's Nan Chuan's Dharma position? And without using the language of saying, "Oh, which way is Nan Chuan?" Nan Chuan is completely dependent on all conditions, like you and the field and the monastery where I live, and the sickle, and everything else. And Nan Chuan is also completely independent of all these things. There's just this flashing expression of the present moment right now of me holding a sickle and the first thought that comes to mind about what's happening. Okay. Do you know what it is?
Maybe the windows are open.
Oh.
The windows are automatic and at a certain time in the afternoon they open up.
Ah. So, instead of explaining the Dharma position, he just demonstrated the Dharma position, which Nan Chuan is this activity right now. This sickle right now is a particular sickle, and it actually cost a particular amount. And that particularity is independent of all conditions, but it also, I couldn't have it without having bought it, so it depends on me having exchanged $3 for it. So it both depends on conditions and it's independent of conditions, this whole moment right now. And of course the monk doesn't get that, so tell me again which way to Nan Chuan. And Nan Chuan continues to just demonstrate the Dharma position of Nan Chuan and his sickle. It cuts very well. Very, very specific.
It's a little threatening sound, because on some level I know that, it isn't, but there's something about a sickle. There's another translation that says I can use it very fast.
And that may be like playing now with metaphors too, of like this Dharma position that fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. It it cuts through all delusion immediately. Like it's like Manjushri's sword. And it's very sharp. It leaves no room for random interpretations. Anyway, some people, can you imagine? Some people hear that story as illogical. Or the eastern mountains travel on water. That these very particular mountains, not just random mountains, but the eastern mountains. Yesterday, I think I said that those were the eastern mountains, but actually those are the eastern mountains, right? Flag Rock is east of here.
You also said that they're all Eastern mountains.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends where you are, and even from a kind of global perspective, that everything in both directions is east, really. Because if you go west far enough, you get all the way around to the east.
Someday, when we have our communities out there, it's all going to be below.
Yeah. East and west, yeah, are interesting terms because they really are totally relative. You know, the east coast, but for, for what's east of the east coast is like for Bermuda. It's Bermuda? It's in the Atlantic Ocean? Is that right? So for Bermuda, that's like a western coastline, you know, the eastern coast of the U.S. So that these very particular eastern mountains, they walk, they move. This very particular form is very flexible and can travel on water. Again, mountains representing particular form, and water representing fluid, clear, colorless, tasteless emptiness. And the way that the mountains and the waters dance together is this reality. It's not illogical. But some people hear the eastern mountains travel on water. It's just an illogical statement. What they mean is that any words having to do with logical thought are not Buddhas and ancestors' expressions. In this way, they consider Huangbo's staff and Linji's shout as being beyond logic and unconcerned with thought. Those are classic Zen ancestors' words. Actually, Huangbo, when asked by Linji what's the great meaning of Buddha Dharma, was just hit with a staff. And then Linji himself, when he finally got that point, then he went on to teach people by shouting. And people think that that has nothing to do with logic and thought. They regard these as great enlightenments that precede the arising of form. Ancient masters used expedient phrases which are beyond understanding to slash entangled vines. Entangled vines is kato, meaning like entangled, discriminating ideas, confused ideas. But Dogen, as he often does, takes that phrase that generally means tangled up, discriminating ideas, and titles a Shobogenzo chapter, Kato, Tangled Vines, but in this case means like the intimate relationship between teacher and student. So almost like the opposite meaning, confused, tangled thought. But here he's using it as actually tangled thought. People who say this have never seen a true master, and they have no eye of understanding. Oh, they're immature, foolish fellows, not even worth discussing. In China, these last 200 or 300 years, there have been many groups of bald-headed rascals. What a pity. The great road of Buddha ancestors is crumbling. People who hold this view are not even as good as listeners of the small vehicles, shravakas, these listeners. and more foolish than those outside the way. They are neither lay people nor monks, neither human nor heavenly beings. They're more stupid than animals who learn the Buddha way. The illogical stories mentioned by you bald-headed fellows are only illogical for you, not for Buddha ancestors. So they seem illogical to you, but the Buddhas and ancestors, they're not illogical. Even though you do not understand, you should not neglect studying the Buddha ancestors' path of understanding. Even if it's beyond understanding, in the end, your present understanding is off the mark. Yeah, that's kind of nice, huh? Like, in the end, actually, you know, we have to go through this stage of logic and understanding the dynamics of what is actually meant by form and emptiness, and what is meant by form itself is emptiness. What's actually meant by emptiness itself is form through logic, but then eventually we may just go beyond that logic and directly experience the Dharma position that's independent of logic, of everything. But even if it's beyond understanding in the end, your present understanding that, like, it's all illogical from the beginning, there's no such thing as logic, that's off the mark. I've personally seen and heard many people like this in Song China. How sad that they do not know about the phrases of logical thought or penetrating logical thought in the phrases and stories. When I laughed at them in China, they had no response and remained silent. Their idea about illogical words is only a distorted view. Even if there's no teacher to show you the original truth, your belief in spontaneous enlightenment is heretical. So, this part about where it says they do not know about the phrases of logical thought or penetrating logical thought in the phrases and stories. Another translation here is that how sad that they do not know that that words are logic and that words are liberated from logic or thought. Which is a little bit different. Instead of saying just logical thought in the stories, penetrating logical thought in the phrases and stories. Another translation there is penetrating that words are liberated from thought. So they, people don't understand that words and thoughts can work together, and they don't also understand that that words are liberated from thought. That has a kind of a different feeling. And both, I think we could say, there's both are good teachings. Words being liberated from thought, we could say that the way we use words is actually free. Words are just kind of a skillful means. They're something we can pick up and play with, like Dogen does, and we can be free from them while using them. Like, there could be an underlying thought that's very clear, but that the words on the surface are maybe not saying that quite right, like baba wawa, that speech is not yet correct. I often feel like that when talking, right? I have some sense of, like, some sense of something that I'd like to express, and then when it starts coming out in words, it starts getting tangled up, and it doesn't, maybe is impossible to understand. But words are actually free from thought. Words can be used in this very free way, that they don't have to fit the thought exactly. And we have this image I think a really beautiful image in the Zen tradition, and also, as I mentioned, I'm into this Vajrayana Dzogchen tradition. they use the same, a lot of the same images as Zen, and that one is that they both share is like writing on water. So it's like, can we use words in the way that like you're writing, and but they leave no trace in the water, like on the surface of the pool. If you write something, the words really are there and they're expressing something, but they're instantly gone. So those words are already gone. And do they leave some trace? Now, in my mind, do I regret? Oh, I didn't say that quite right. Can we go back and fix it? No, those words are gone. And thoughts, likewise, are like thoughts in meditation can be like writing on water. It's a great image. You can bring that up if during zazen, if you feel like we're getting stuck in thoughts and you know, I can't let go of these thoughts and they're just like they're eroding my settled zazen, to actually just recognize that aspect of thoughts that are like writing on water. That as soon as we think them, they're gone. They leave no trace. They actually they appeared for the moment that they appeared, but then they're gone, and the water's just where they were. It has no trace of those words. Very different from writing on paper. Right? So this whole point here, and also he brings up at the end, your belief in spontaneous enlightenment is heretical. This was a big issue in Dogen's time, in the Tendai school, this teaching of like original enlightenment or spontaneous enlightenment, meaning that it's basically like an extension of the Buddha nature teaching, which is an ancient Indian teaching that all beings have, and the true nature of all beings is Buddha nature, is totally enlightened nature, is our true nature. That's who we really are. We do have that. But the kind of traditional way of putting, of talking about Buddha nature is that even though that's the case, it's obscured by our habitual karmic thought and dualistic thought, and that's what blocks it, even though it's already here, which is a beautiful teaching, and because we don't have to produce that Buddha nature, create that Buddha nature, it's here right now. We just have to see through the blockage, see through the obscuration to it. But the Tendai school, in the name of non-duality, took this further and further till they basically said, well, the obscurations themselves are also just the nature of Buddha, which is true, right? But it's like this can be taken so far since the obscurations are already it, everything's Buddha. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do, and everyone's already completely enlightened and fully manifest Buddha. So the end. So obviously then there's no reason to practice or follow precepts or anything like that, because whether or not you practice is equally Buddha. Whether you follow the precepts or not is equally Buddha. That's what came to be the understanding of this like original enlightenment or spontaneous enlightenment, and everyone's spontaneously enlightened from the beginning. Which is, you hear stuff like that in Zen too. And you even hear Dogen, there's traces of that kind of thing. So I think it's very close, which is why that teaching could be like the dominant teaching in Japan in Dogen's time. This Tendai school was the main form of Buddhism, and the dominant understanding was this Hongaku, or you know, original enlightenment. But Dogen was critical of this. As you probably have heard, this was his kind of original question that brought him to practice. Well, I've heard that everything's already Buddha, because you know, Dogen was in the Tendai school. He heard that very early on. You're already Buddha. There's nothing to do. And he said, well, then why did all his ancestors practice so diligently if they were already Buddha. And this was a big problem for him. And we can say the resolution of this problem for him was his famous saying and understanding that practice and verification of Buddhahood are not two. So, whereas original enlightenment is like, you don't need, practice has nothing to do with it, everything is already it. But practice must be united, Buddhahood, this awakening is expressed through practice and completely not separate from practice. You could say that was the resolution of his great original koan. And we can see the same tendency, the same question about spontaneous enlightenment, and also this question about, well, what about these teachings, all these great teachings of the ancestors and the sutra teachings that maybe were getting rejected and neglected by the practitioners of his time. This is when Dogen was a young lad in China when he was 25, right? When he met his teacher, the Hokyoki, the record of Dogen's, it's like Dogen's journals in China. It's the earliest thing that we have written by him. And very nice, because you get a sense of how Dogen thought, like before his awakening, and the kind of practice he was taking up, and the conversations, kind of informal conversations with his teacher, Wu Jing, that he recorded. So he asks Wu Jing, nowadays, elders of different monasteries say that only direct experience without discrimination, hearing the unhearable and seeing the unseeable, is the way of Buddha ancestors. So they hold up a fist or a whisk, shout or beat people with sticks. This kind of teaching doesn't do anything to awaken students. So this was, really early on. No, this is Dogen. That's Dogen asking Wu Jing. Yeah, he's asking, what's with this, teacher? Nowadays, people just shout and hit and do these spontaneous things and say that Zen's all about this, direct experience without discrimination. He has some doubt about this. And it's funny, because, there's always subtlety here. Direct experience without discrimination. Dogen praises that kind of thing many times in his later teachings too. But it's this particular, maybe, abuse of that kind of thing. Like, Zen is just like doing whatever, so let's just do whatever, and that's it. And don't bother to try to understand in a rational or logical way. So I think it's interesting that early on he's doubting this, and then, what is it, 15 years later, this rant in the Mountains and Water Sutra is almost the same thing here, right? Dogen goes on in this question. He says, furthermore, these teachers don't allow students to inquire about the essentials of the Buddha's guidance, and they discourage practices that aim to bear fruit in the future or in future lives. Are these teachers really teaching the way of Buddha ancestors? So, interestingly too here, right, it's these spontaneous expression teachers, they don't allow students to inquire about the Buddha's teachings. Kind of like, that's just, in the sutras, we're beyond that now. Mm-hmm. Just, stick your face in a peach blossom. So, Dogen doubts this. And Dogen was always really into the, studying the words of the Buddhas and the sutras and the ancestors' teachings. So, basically, Wu Jing answers, he kind of agrees with Dogen. You know, he says, we need to pay attention to cause and effect, future teachings, study the Buddhas and ancestors, and so on. He says, after Dogen's questioning a little more, Rujin says, those who say that sentient beings are already Buddhas are really professing a belief in spontaneous enlightenment. So that he criticizes this Japanese Tendai understanding. Rujin again says, those who say that sentient beings are already Buddhas are really professing a belief in spontaneous enlightenment. This view is not at all in accord with the way. Sometimes we kind of say this, right? We're all already Buddha. You know, but strictly speaking, we all have Buddha nature. We all equally share Buddha nature. That really is who we are. That's our true nature. But that's a little different than saying we are already Buddhas. You know, maybe it's a technical point, but you could say it's the difference between heaven and earth. And Rujing says, this view that sentient beings are already Buddhas is not in accord with the way. And then he says, to equate I, maybe meaning as a sentient being, with Buddha is to mistake unattainment for attainment and unenlightenment for enlightenment. So he's making some discriminations. It's not all the same. There's unenlightenment and enlightenment. And in the realm of non-duality, we can't find any difference. But we don't want to get stuck there. You should know that Eastern mountains traveling on water is the bones and marrow of the Buddha ancestors. All waters appear at the foot of the Eastern mountains. Accordingly, all mountains ride on clouds and walk in the sky. All these different perspectives on mountains and waters, I think there's certain times when Dogen, I feel like, is really shifting into the presentation of these sides of form and emptiness and the relationship between them. At least it makes a great teaching to see it that way. That all water, if this clear, tasteless, fluid, unfixed water is an image for emptiness, and the eastern, very particular eastern mountains, that particular form, that all waters appear at the foot of the eastern mountains. As a poetic image, this relationship at the foot, at the very bottom of form, is emptiness. At the, you know, to study, I think this is how we actually approach emptiness. We take a particular form, not just like generic form. Like, let's just imagine how forms in general are empty. I think the way in practice to look at this relationship is to look at Eastern mountains, at this watch, at particular form, this body and mind, this present experience, and go to the very bottom of it. Like, really examine it closely. What is it at the bottom, at the root, at the feet of the form, and at the very bottom of the form? Like, when we first look at it without really getting to the bottom of it, then maybe very hard to open to its emptiness. But at the very bottom of the form is the water. All waters appear at the foot of the eastern mountains. Accordingly, all mountains ride on clouds and walk in the sky. Sky is also not sure if it's the character here, but usually the character that's used for emptiness is also the character in Chinese that's used for sky. Ku is the way the Chinese translate shunyata is sky. So mountains walk in the sky. Above all waters are all mountains. So this is the other side. You know, it's not just some ethereal emptiness disconnected from form. This again is the problem of saying that emptiness is like this mysterious source from which all forms arise. That's not quite like the view of Buddha Dharma. It's more like that emptiness is actually the way things are. Emptiness is never it's not like there's an emptiness and then form comes out of it. That sounds like magic or something. It's more that emptiness is the true nature of all forms, and that true nature of all forms appears as form. But you never have one without the other. That's the Heart Sutra, right? Form itself always is emptiness. Emptiness itself always is form, or you know, in the Heart Sutra's case, form is short for form, feelings, perceptions, formations, consciousness. It doesn't have to be particularly solid form. Emptiness itself is feelings, for example. But it's always a phenomena. Emptiness must be, it must be expressed as a phenomena. Water must always have a mountain. How does he say it? Above all waters are all mountains. Walking beyond and walking within are both done on water. All mountains walk with their toes on all waters and splash there. Or another translation of splash is set them dancing. Set the waters dance. The mountains walk with their toes along the water and splash around. You could even say it. So the place where the very bottom of the mountains meets the flowing water, the toes of the mountains, that place is very splashy. Where mountains meet waters, where form meets emptiness, is a very dynamic, lively, and dancing place, like kind of like this place. Isn't this the place where the toes of the mountains are splashing about in the water? Like every place. Thus, in walking, there are 7 paths vertical and 8 paths horizontal, which is apparently a Chinese way of saying like total freedom in all directions. 7 paths vertical, 8 paths horizontal. This is practice realization. Literally, it actually says here, I think it's nice to bring out the literal here. It says something like, this practice realization is not non-existent. It's a double negative. Foo moo. Not nothing. This Shusho Fumu practice verification is not nothing, or is not non-existent. And do you know the story of where the Dogen got his great phrase, practice and realization? Does anyone know that story? Then I'll tell it. Because the story is pretty good too. He got it from a classic Zen story of the 6th ancestor of Zen, Wei Nung, was abiding in his Dharma position, and along came Nanyue, who became one of his disciples and was the beginning of the stream of the whole Linji lineage. Nanyue came to the 6th ancestor for the first time. And the 6th ancestor said, where are you from? And Nan Yue said, from Mount Sung. And Sixth Ancestor said, what is it that thus comes? What is this that has come thus to this moment right here with me now? You know, thus come is a Chinese way of saying the Tathagata. Nyo Rai, it actually means thus come. In this case, they usually don't translate it as what is the Tathagata, because actually I just saw that it doesn't say Nyo Rai, it actually says Emo Rai. Emo is another way of saying thus. So I think it's better to translate it as what is it that thus comes? But it's maybe a little play on, you know, what is the Tathagata? What is Buddha? Tathagata is a name for Buddha, the thus come one. But you, here now, what is that, that comes thus right now? Comes from thusness. As a little aside, thus come, it just occurs to me, is a really nice epithet that the Buddha called himself, Tathagata. When speaking about himself, he said, Tathagata is going to have lunch now, you know, when talking about himself in the sutras. And I think it's nice because it's these two sides again. Thusness is another word for emptiness. Where nothing's coming and going, and then we have this side of appearances and coming and going. So you have the thus come one and the thus gone one. It's like the form and emptiness one, the Tathagata. So what is it that thus comes? And I think some versions of the story say he actually just kind of sat with that for like 8 years, that question, Nan Yue did. He just kind of, that was his practice of what is it that thus comes. And 8 years later, he stayed there with the sixth ancestor, working on that for 8 years. And then he said, teacher, I have the answer now. And sixth ancestor said, well, what is it that thus comes? And his magnificent answer after 8 years of working on this, his brilliant exposition was, just say it's this, misses the mark. It took him 8 years to say that. I mean, that's a funny story. Just say it's this, misses the mark. That's pretty good. I mean, if anything else he could have said, like, would miss the mark. to say anything about it misses it. But then the sixth ancestor went on to test him a little bit and said, some versions would say, like, then is there no practice and verification? Is there no shusho? Another translation is, does this depend on practice and verification? Yeah, to say it's this misses the mark, does that saying depend? You know, this place that you've reached after 8 years of to say it's this misses the mark, does that depend on your practice and verifying that truth? That's one way of saying it. The other one would be saying, are you saying then, if anything you say misses the mark, then is there no practice and realization? In other words, it's again around this. Are you saying there's just spontaneous enlightenment? There's no point in practice. There's no point in verifying Buddha because everything is already it. And Nan Yue says, it's not that there's no practice and verification. It's just that they can't be defiled. So that's this actually line straight out of that here. It's not that there's no practice in verification. Dogen says, thus in walking there's seven paths vertical and eight paths horizontal. Literally says, it's not that there's no practice in verification. Or practice in verification is not non-existent. And the sixth ancestor approves that and says something like this practice in realization being not non-existent is what all Buddhas protect and maintain. And you are thus and I am thus too. There was a little transmission there. Later he became that Dharma heir of the sixth ancestor. So Dogen loved this story, and that became one of his main teachings. And you can see how with Dogen's style and often what he's trying to say, this makes sense that this would be like the central teaching for Dogen. Practice and realization are not non-existent. Double negatives are nice, right? It's different than saying there really is practice and verification. That's going too far. That's reifying something. But we don't say it's not that there's no practice and verification. That's going too far the other way. That's like falling into a nihilistic view that there's no practice, there's no realization. It's not that there's no practice. It's not that there's no realization. It's just that they can't be defiled by our ideas of them. And they can't be defiled by separating them. That's another nice point. Shu Shou, practice dash verification, can't be defiled by saying practice leads up to verification. Does that make sense? That to say like practice is the cause or the result of verification kind of defiles them by separating them. But practice and verification are not two. Doesn't defile them. Now we move on to water. That was basically, water was included here, but it was, Dogen was really celebrating mountains for the last page and a half. Now he's going to dive into the water. Water is neither strong nor weak, neither wet nor dry, neither moving nor still, neither cold nor hot, neither existent nor non-existent, neither deluded nor enlightened. So that's the emphasis here with water, right? It's not that like mountains are like particularly over there in the east. They're not in the west. Those mountains are in the east, not in the west. But now when we're in the realm of water, it's not in the east or the west. This is free from all extremes. This is like, it sounds a little like the Heart Sutra, right? It's not this, it's not that, it's not the other. This is the negating side. Mountains are like the positive side. They explode out of the earth in our face as these solid forms. And water, you try to get a hold of it, you can't do it. So if we see water as emptiness, this is very straightforward then. Water is not this, it's not that, it's not anything we think it is. Well, when water solidifies, though, it's harder than a diamond. Isn't that true? Is it interesting that a giant ship, oil tanker with, made out of metal a foot thick, can hit frozen water and be like broken in half and sink. Right? It's like water can sink a metal ship with its solidity. It's kind of amazing. It happens, right? When it solidifies, it's harder than diamond. Who can crack it? When water melts, it's gentler than milk. Who can destroy it? Who can destroy it? Yeah, you can't. It's interesting about water, right? You can't destroy it. Like a mountain, you can kind of destroy. You can use dynamite, and you can still going to be pieces of stuff there, but you can kind of like destroy a mountain, but you can't like obliterate water. You can't. It's just, you can evaporate it. It's not really destroying it. Likewise, you can destroy form, but you can't destroy emptiness, because it's not a thing that can be destroyed. Do not doubt that these are the characteristics water manifests. Genjo. A lot of genjos in this. This one, again, one of Dogen's favorite things. Actualization, manifestation. Genjo. You should reflect on the moment when you see the water of the 10 directions as the water of the 10 directions. This is not just studying the moment when human and heavenly beings see water. This is studying the moment when water sees water. This is a complete understanding. So this is just playing with how we study and understand things. Us humans and heavenly beings. You could even say how we understand Dogen's writing right now. We're some humans trying to understand this. But at the same time, there's like the Mountains and Water Sutra, understanding the Mountains and Water Sutra has nothing to do with us. So we should understand this also. This is a complete understanding. Again, I'd like to mention the more literal translation here, because it's just shusho again. That's literally here. Water practices and verifies water. It's a little sad that the Kaz didn't get that in there, because that's, I think, one of the great phrases combining these here, right? Practice and verification are not non-existent, but now we have water practicing and verifying water. That's a great kind of just saying to contemplate for the rest of our life. You know, emptiness is practicing and verifying emptiness. You should go forward and backward and leap beyond the vital path where other fathoms other. Now we're moving into, we have previously had the 4 views of mountains. Now we have the 4 views of water. And this is a really one of my favorite teachings, partly because I am a great fan of the Yogacara tradition. You know, Yogacara or Chittamatra is the Indian mind-only tradition, which is forms a lot of the roots of Zen, and it's just, it's very far out, and it's very liberating to contemplate, and it's these teachings of the Lankavatara Sutra, the Sanghivir Mochana Sutra are the bases for these Yogacara teachings, and then Sanghivir Mochana. We have a new book by Tenshin Roshi called The Third Turning of the Wheel. It's a commentary on that sutra. So here, yeah. It's called The Sutra Unraveling the Mysteries. So for people who are interested in mind-only teachings, that's a nice new book. I saw it in the library here. The Third Turning of the Wheel. Taught partly at Tassajara. The Third Turning being the Yogacara teachings. Anyway, again, I would try to refrain from getting totally sidetracked into the Yogacara school. But this is a classic Yogacara teaching about Asanga. Asanga and Vasubandhu were these two brothers who are considered the founders of that school based on those two sutras. Basically, just like mind only says, that's the basic, maybe we could say the basic premise of the school is that everything that we can possibly experience is actually mind. No thing is actually truly external to mind, even though it sure appears that way. And very intricate teachings, and very logical teachings that come to prove that that's the case. And one of the great famous proofs of Asanga is this, Four Views of Water. I think it's really great. It's pretty simple, and it demonstrates this principle of mind only quite clearly. So here's Dogen's version of it. All beings do not see mountains and waters in the same way. Some beings see water as a jeweled ornament. And in the classic Indian version, it's talking about these different, the six realms of sentient beings. From the top, the gods, the devas, the jealous gods who are not quite gods, but they're the wannabe gods who are, And then there's the humans. Those are like the upper realms. And then as you go down, it's like the animal realm and the hungry ghost realm and the hell realm. And the six realms. So some people talk about it, they're psychological states of all humans. Some people say, no, literally there are these invisible beings. We only see the middle two of humans and animals appear to our vision. But sometimes we maybe have a sense of ghosts and other types of beings. Maybe devas, we sometimes get whiffs of. So, because that's a kind of classic Buddhist thing, they say those beings in these six different realms experience water in completely different ways. So, according to these old teachings, the devas, the gods, see water as like jewel ornaments or palaces. You could just imagine. We don't know what that's like, but they don't see water the same way we do. They see it as jeweled ornaments. But they do not regard jewel ornaments as water, meaning like our jewel, like a human necklace, they don't see that as water, but they see water as jeweled ornament. What in the human realm corresponds to their water? We only see their jeweled ornaments as water. For them it's jeweled ornaments, for us it's water. Some beings see water as wondrous blossoms, but they do not use blossoms as water. Maybe also the gods see the water as these flower blossoms. Hungry ghosts see water as raging fire or pus and blood. Water is a very unpleasant thing. They basically can't drink it. They're very thirsty, but it turns into like fire and blood when they try to drink it. That's why Siddhiki ceremony, through mantra power, we transform food to make it edible for them. The dragons and also fish see water as a palace or a pavilion. Some beings see water as the seven treasures or a wish-granting jewel. I don't know what kinds those are. Some beings see water as a forest or a wall. Maybe that would be like a sailor out at sea in a storm, maybe starts seeing the water as like this wall that we have to get through, or a dense forest that's going to be really hard to get through. A sailor in a storm might see water that way. Some see it as the Dharma nature of pure liberation, the true human body, or as the form of body and essence of mind. So maybe that some bodhisattvas or Dharma practitioners might start seeing water like that. Human beings see water as water. And maybe we could add in scientists see water as two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen. So these beings see water in different ways, and we might say, well, I don't know about all these six realms, but I think the most the best example is just fish, because we really can relate, I think, to, we can see how fish deal with water. And we don't know exactly their experience, but when you look at a fish in the water, you can pretty much quite strongly intuit that the way that they are relating to that water is a very different way than we relate to the water, right? And also the way they relate to the air is different. Well, it's almost the opposite, right? Like a fish being pulled out of the water into the air is like drowning. It'd be like us being pulled out of the water. Like they can't breathe in the air. So the water is kind of like our air. And we might say, so this is just to contemplate that and contemplate it deeply, to thoroughly investigate how fish might see water, is really, I find, really profound. It can really open our mind to this mind-only teaching. Because I think there's a tendency for us to say, but this is, the way we see water is the real way. Right? Fish are kind of weird. They're just weird and crazy. And we're like, we are the standard. And they're the abnormal, you know, but like, isn't that so human-centric? And that's kind of a way that, like, mind-only is kind of like, we get, like, in our own fixed view of how things are, but things are really experienced different for other people, as well as other species and types of beings. And so, again, we might say that... And I bring up the scientist view, which Dokken doesn't do that, but I think sometimes I think in modern America, we think the scientific view is really the bottom line. Like two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen, that's really what water is. And even humans, normal humans, are a little deluded. Like we see this as something to drink. But, you know, if we have to be really most accurate, it's really hydrogen and oxygen. But I would say that's not really what it is either. That's just a scientific view. So that's a certain species called scientists that see it as these certain molecules. And the mind-only point is that, this is the key point, is not like there is one real water that is, we can't quite, none of us quite know what it really is, but we all see it in a slightly different way. That's not it. Right? That there's this one true water that's actually inconceivable. It's actually that, because if that were the case, then we'd have to, like, we should really try to find that then and locate what the really true water is. The mind-only perspective is that we really can't find any, like, objective basis onto which we're all projecting. You could say mind-only is another way of, another way to say it is, all sentient beings are projecting reality onto, you know, as external to them. And so it might not be that hard to say that, like, well, there really is an objective reality that none of us can quite get at, and we're all projecting onto that. And all we know is our projections, but, you know, maybe a Buddha could see the true reality that we're projecting onto. Mind only would say there isn't actually an objective reality that we're all projecting onto. There isn't like that true water that we're all seeing in different ways. It's that there just is no objective reality, actually. It's all just projection upon projection upon projection, and there's nothing like beneath that. And yeah,
understand.
Yeah, it's pretty hard. Because then we might say, well, like, how? What are we projecting onto then? You know, how are we creating this? And the story of this tradition is saying that it's all based on what we call the storehouse consciousness, alaya vijnana, is like that each person is this inconceivably vast and complex collection of karmic tendencies that has evolved from beginningless time, and all of us are interacting, and we're all interdependent with each other. All, we could say all these storehouse consciousnesses that we all are mutually interpenetrating, but they're also individual karmic patterns. In that way, it's kind of like a Dharma position, right? Interdependent and independent at the same time. And that though we have these tendencies in the storehouse consciousness, for very strong tendencies as sentient beings to project the appearance of an external world. It's like a virtual reality, or like the Matrix. Have you seen that movie? I'll try not to get started on the Matrix.
So I'm wondering how this is not another speculative view.
Well, could be. It is a view made up by humans, right? Or discovered by humans. And it's conceptual view, right? So we could say that about any Dharma teaching, right? So but it's the nice thing about it is it's very, when you go into that tradition, it's very detailed, and all the questions that we have about it are common questions. And that they're like Asanga and Vasubandhu are like amazingly thorough about like answering all our doubts. So it's like I feel like maybe there's still like small places that they have left. Maybe there's still questions can arise, but it's a very complex system, but very thorough in the sense I from my personal experience getting really into studying that, I feel like. And I have my questions, and then I go back to them, and they kind of say, "Oh no, this is how it works. How could it be like that?" And then, "Oh, it's like this." And then you get to, so it starts really like I feel like it really affects me enough to be like, it really could be the case that there really is no objective reality. It's not like I personally feel like I'm completely convinced, mm-hmm. actually, but through logic. And through logic and reasoning, it can
so
get pretty close.
Way of undermining our belief in
yeah,
reality.
Yeah, that's what it's doing. Okay. Yeah, and even within this is one of the Mahayana philosophical schools. The other main school being Madhyamaka, the system of Nagarjuna, which does a very similar thing, but they're slightly different. And in systems where they intensively study this, they'll say, well, these two views do have some contradictions. And like in most Tibetan systems where they get really into studying these, they'll say, actually, the Yogacara is somewhat provisional and Madhyamaka wins out in the end. Because it leaves you nothing, no ground at all. And really, talking to modern teachers in this tradition, it looks like there's almost no contradiction between the two views. It's just that when you're studying it, they almost like set it up as a gradation of more and more subtlety of view. So they almost set up the Yogacara just in order for the Madhyamaka to have something to critique. Basically, they start to say that the Yogacara people, mind-only people, start to in a very, very slight way, start to they say there's nothing but mind, but then they start to reify the mind a little bit. But actually, if you go to the original teachings of Asanga and Vasubandhu, they never do that. This mind is totally empty, also.
Yeah, I just
I'm curious about Building's view of the universe, which is not that, right? Which is not a mind-blowing view.
It's not?
Well, that's what I'm asking. Mm. And I don't, there's some things that he says, like when he talks about the moment when water sees water.
Mm.
What is that?
When water sees water. Maybe we could take that as like when we are completely out of the picture, as like any idea of us, like a person seeing emptiness, for example, when it was more like emptiness poured into emptiness, or the world just being the world. And of course, you know, if you step out of that, of course we are in that picture, but as an experiential thing, there's no sense of self and other.
Maybe there's like, no water.
Yeah, and there's no water. I mean, especially if we're talking about water is an image for emptiness.
It's an interesting point, because if it's mind-only...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay.
is that what you're saying? If it's mind-only, then how can water see water if there's no mind there? That. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just don't see it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't.
And then later on,
well, later
he talks about water's freedom depends.
Yeah, that part is an interesting one I want to get to about mind only there. But is the water. Yeah, I wouldn't say that Dogen is always coming from a mind only perspective. Yeah. I think he is influenced by, and sometimes it seems really clear, and he knows this is a Sangha story that he knows of, but he's going beyond it too.
Yeah, I just don't want to see this as a mind-only teaching.
Well, in fact, we haven't even brought it up until the third day, right? I've restrained myself, right? I've been waiting for this story. No, it's true. That's just one perspective. We don't want to get locked into Heart Sutra or Mind Only or Nagarjuna or Dogen or mountains or waters.
Or the Matrix.
Or the Matrix.
And I wanted to apologize for blurting that out, but I have been with you when you have brought it up. And all of a sudden, you sort of lose touch with what the Buddhist references are.
Mm-hmm.
Get caught up in the storyline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we won't get into the whole story of the Matrix, although I think it is a good... I won't go there today. I do think the movie is a really nice demonstration of a lot of Yogacara principles. And we need modern examples, too.
No, we don't. We need tried and true.
Well, here, this is a tried and true, the four views of water... And Dogen adds in a few for fun, too, besides gods, fish, hungry ghosts, and humans, I think is the classic one. To go on, water is seen as dead or alive depending on causes and conditions. Or, you know, literally it's like killed and brought to life. And we could take that as like, killing and giving life in Zen is like, often represents like negation and affirmation. So you could say water is like negated as truly existent or affirmed as appearing in this world, depending on causes and conditions. Thus, the views of all beings are not the same. You should question this matter now. Are there many ways to see one thing, or is it a mistake to see many forms as one thing? You should pursue this beyond the limit of pursuit. So this is this point of like, is there one true water that all these beings are seeing slightly differently, or is there really not one true thing? Pursue this beyond the limit of pursuit. Accordingly, endeavors in practice realization of the way are not limited to one or two kinds. This is this nice phrase. Endeavors in practice realization is Shusho Bendo. Bendo is another popular phrase of Dogen that means like wholehearted exertion of the way. Bendo Wa is one of his important fascicles. Wholehearted way. So the practice and realization of the wholehearted endeavor of the way is not limited to one or two kinds. The ultimate realm has 1,000 kinds and 10,000 kinds. When we think about the meaning of this, it seems that there is water for various beings, but there is no original water. There is no water common to all types of beings. That's the kind of this classic Yogacara thing. There's no original water or like basis of water upon which all different beings are projecting. It's all mutual projections from everyone's storehouse consciousness contributing to this kind of holographic, like this room we're all projecting from all different angles, but there's not a real thing upon which we're projecting it. It's like layers of mind and just like, and again, this types of species is a good example, because if you put a fish in this room, it is not going to be the small retreat hall. Right? You could say, well, it's still a wooden floor. It's not a wooden floor for fish, right? It's like, it's not, and we think, well, no, it really is this way. They just wouldn't understand that it's the retreat hall. But just if you contemplate that, you'll see that like, it's really not a retreat hall for a fish. Or even for a dog, for that matter. It's not the small retreat hall. It's like a place, a warm place to sleep or a place to pee or something, right? It's like they really do, you know, again, it's hard, we can't be in a dog's mind, but it's not what we think it is, according to them. But because we're humans and we're Tassajara humans, that's like we share, all of our storehouse consciousnesses share the conceptual idea of small retreat hall, so therefore we can all agree on it. That's why there can be so much agreement that it actually, then we believe that it is a small retreat hall. Because we mentally project in very similar ways, both as humans, as Zen practitioners, and as people of Tassajara. The more we share, the more we agree that we know what this is. So now we get to this interesting part that I think is true, is kind of contradicts the usual mind-only thing. I think Dogen's maybe trying to do this. Water for these various kinds of beings does not depend on mind or body. Is this what you're referring to? Yeah, that's a good one, huh? That one's kind of got me. I'm like, wait a second. Because mind-only would say, yeah, the... you know, that this water that drinking now, the classic view is it depends on my mind. And if you see it as drinking water, it depends on your mind. Fish, it's probably not drinking water. That depends on their mind. It all depends on mind, is the view. But here, this water for these various types of being does not depend on mind or body. Does not arise from actions, which also mind only would say our view that is water does arise from karmic actions in our storehouse consciousness, basically many, many times before, from when we were very little kids, taught that this was drinking water, we store that information, so it gets easier and easier to see this as drinking water. When you're first born, things are much more flexible, right? But it's not really drinking water for a little while, but due to that karmic conditioning, it becomes more and more like it really is. Does not arise from actions, does not depend on self or other. Water's freedom depends only on water. So, I understand this as there is the side of that. The Dharma position of water is, of this water, does depend on mind and other conditions. In parentheses, all the other conditions also depend on mind and are of the nature of mind. But It's also independent of all those conditions, right? In this moment, this particular water right now, in its Dharma position, that one aspect of its Dharma position where it's independent is like, doesn't depend on mind or anything. It's like totally free of all our ideas of mind only, all our ideas of emptiness and form. It's just this here, now. And that's in a way, that's its freedom. That so the water's freedom depends only on water. And if we look at it as emptiness, if we're again going back to water as emptiness, I think we could say even traditionally that emptiness doesn't really depend on anything. I had this conversation with one of these Buddhist scholars about this point, because it seems like you could say that doesn't emptiness depend on form, actually? Because again, we have no emptiness independent of form, no floating around emptiness. It always goes with form. So then do we say emptiness depends on form? I think the discussion I was having with him was actually same thing, but we were talking about ultimate truth and conventional truth. And so there's some debate, maybe it's semantics, but this was something my teacher Tenshin wrote. He said ultimate truth dependently arises. He might even said emptiness dependently arises. And my ears perked up. I was like, this is not usually traditionally taught that way, that emptiness is not dependent on anything. It's it doesn't come and go. It doesn't dependently arise, because emptiness doesn't arise. Only things arise, appear. Only phenomena arise, but emptiness is not a phenomena. It's the nature of all phenomena that doesn't come and go. And what do you mean? I said, well, emptiness depends on form, or ultimate truth depends on conventional truth. And I took it to this, you know, classically trained Kenpo, which is like a Tibetan PhD in that system. And he's like, no, we don't say that emptiness is dependent on anything. I said, well, what about dependent on form? And he's like, well, you could kind of say that, but it's usually not said that way, you know, because either way has a problem. If you say that emptiness is dependent on form and it dependently arises, then it's like a phenomenon that dependently arises. But if you say it's independent of form, that's not quite right either, because it always goes with form. But it's like the nature of, like, you know, like the brownness of the floor, the brownness of this wood is like, is kind of like the nature, it's a quality of that wood. And do we say that brownness depends on the wood? In a way, in that example, I think we would say that the brownness depends on the wood, because actually the brownness is a conditioned phenomena. But it's kind of like that. It's like this quality of something, but this particular quality called emptiness is not a phenomenal quality, right? It's an absence. It's a lack of independent existence. So how could an absence come and go? Right? How could an absence arise? I don't know if you can follow that.
I was going to say, without water, none of us would be here. This floor wouldn't be here. This curtain wouldn't be here. Nothing would be here without water.
You mean like actual water?
Actual water. Like water grew this. Mm-hmm. This brownness is dependent on water.
So yeah.
Are the plants that made that curtain, you know, the creeper,
yeah,
the body?
Yeah. Water as a phenomena, I think we can say. Yeah. It all depends on water. But if we're saying, if we're talking about actually emptiness, it's not a phenomenon, then it's hard to say that anything depends, that emptiness then depends on anything, or anything depends on emptiness. And yet, there's this total intimate relationship between emptiness and all phenomena. All phenomena are marked by emptiness. Or form itself is emptiness.
To me, it seems that way. If you look at it, look at it closely, it's kind of like saying that everything is mind in that sense. And even emptiness itself is dependent, or it is within perception.
Yeah, well, definitely if we're talking about any experience or idea of emptiness, then it's definitely dependent on form. And I think we might have even gone there. Like, are you talking about the idea, the concept of emptiness, or actual emptiness? And I think you might have gone there. Well, what do you mean, actual emptiness? So we have that way of...
What I was going to say is that it seems to me that emptiness is a concept.
Well, any way that we think of it is a concept.
I mean, right? And is there something that actually, is there something behind that concept? Is there...
not a thing.
Right, or even a lack of thing, because you have to have a thing to have a lack of a thing,
Yeah, you have to have a thing to have a lack of a thing.
So...
In that way, we could say they're dependent. Yeah. It's just a tricky thing. I mean, this is a point that you can... take home as homework, and I will for a while probably. That it's almost like the nice thing about contemplating it is it gets your mind really in tune with what we mean by emptiness, just to consider the question, and some of these things of like, maybe it is just a concept, and yet then what is the realization of emptiness? Free from concepts. So it's really, for me, it's a really interesting topic, and it's maybe where this logical words break down. This thing about, is it dependent or independent? Mm-hmm. It's like you can't touch it there anymore. To say it's this misses the mark. To say it's dependent or independent misses the mark. Well, then is there no practice and verification of emptiness? It's not that there's no practice and verification of emptiness. It's just that they can't be defiled by this discussion. Oh, it's time to stop. Luckily, water's freedom depends only on water.